This is ACS Voices, the diversity podcast from the American Chemical Society. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Fiore Walker, manager of the Department of Diversity Programs.
Hello, and welcome to the Black History Month edition of ACS Voices. In today's episode, we will have for you two interviews. The first one will be done by a colleague of mine, Catherine Stevens, and she's interviewing Dr. Rachel Burks. The second interview will be done by me, and I'll be interviewing Dr. Terry Quinn Gray. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
There we go. So my first question for you is, what inspired you to become a chemist?
So I've always been interested in, well, not always, but since junior high, I've been interested in forensic science. And within that, I've always been interested in being able, if you have like a real unknown, how do you figure out what something that you don't know what it is? And it just became clear to me that chemistry, you know, was the way to do that. You know, as far as kind of my foray into it, is that you would do all these chemical tests or analytical tests to figure it out. So I definitely came to chemistry through analytical.
Very cool. Did anything like CSI or popular culture inspire you as well? I'm sure you get that a lot.
Yeah, I am old. So it was pre-CSI. It was actually a field trip that we took in junior high and to Washington, D.C. And we got to visit and interact with some FBI kind of personnel. And found out more about, I had never even knew about forensic science in this way or science really in that kind of an applied way. And that's really what that whole trip really blew my mind. And then ever since then, just kind of, you know, got all these books about the library and really kind of went down the rabbit hole to figure that out.
That's awesome. So how has the field changed since the start of your career or even since you were in school?
Well, it's funny because talking about pop culture and forensic science is, you know, the revolutionary nature of the field has, and the biggest revolution being, say, like, you know, forensic DNA testing. It kind of follows Murder, She Wrote. And if you think about the show Murder, She Wrote, which was on for, I think it's 12 years, it really did bridge that introduction of that type of analysis into the criminal legal system. And so you kind of early on in the show's history, you saw things like ABO blood typing, you know, lots of course, latent prints have been around and kind of print matching, quote unquote, has been around for a long time. So you saw a lot of that. And then by the end of the show, it was DNA this, DNA that. So that kind of shows you like a real trajectory of how things changed. But, you know, forensic science, or really the application, because all forensic science is the application of science to the law. And in some way that has been done for a really long time. As far as, you know, how to kind of track things and whether to prove something is, you know, what you think it is, whether it's in a kind of, we always think of it as a criminal, you know, kind of context, you know, like a violent crime kind of thing. But when you think about kind of the history of analytical chemistry, is, you know, actually proving currency is what you say it is. Is that actually gold? Is that really silver? Is that actually bronze? You know, that kind of validation of currency or anything that can be traded that has monetary value, like salt at one time or spices, like those types of tests are also, you know, analytical or forensic in nature because those things often had kind of real legal consequences behind them. And so if you kind of really broaden the scope out in that way, and then if you add in poisons and that kind of thing, which is also in the kind of the history of forensic science analytical been a big motivator to the creation and expansion of tests, then it's been around for a really long time. Some way to identify people or things. People have been working on that for, you know, hundreds of years. Hundreds and hundreds of years in ways that you can make observations or do some type of test to get identifying or classifying information. And so that part's really, you know, been around for a long time. And of course, we make a lot of advances. The tests that we use today, you know, in some ways can be pretty advanced just because instrumentation has radically changed and our ability to process information computationally. But there are also a lot of, you know, color tests that have been around for a long time. We're still using them, or, you know, current tests are based on really old tests, you know, so there's always kind of evolving, but some of these things have been around for a long time and they've worked pretty well.
Very cool. So can you give me a brief summary of what your current research is like and what an average day in the lab looks like for you?
So in my current research, I am focused on designing and fabricating sensing systems. Typically, they're color-changing systems or fluorescent chemiluminescent systems, some type of a luminescent event or color-changing event, which then, you know, when they're exposed to some analyte, typically the analytes I look at are what I would say are forensic interests, right? So all of your DEA scheduled drugs and your explosives and your weapons, all the nefarious ones, and then all their related, like, you know, precursors and that kind of thing, maybe metabolites for certain processes. And then when there's some kind of a color change or a luminescent event, then my group also works a lot in image analysis. So we take pictures of stuff, or video, which is just, you know, series of still images, and we analyze the images to look at changes to color and what the camera is capturing, how those that's changing with the reaction and time. And then we get that data because we're analyzing color space like red, green, blue, or say hue, saturation, vibrancy. So that gives us actual numbers. And then we can do stats, typically multivariate stats, to see if we can classify all the things that we're monitoring at any one time to distinguish them from other things. So, you know, if you Google chemist, you might get pictures of people staring at brightly colored solutions. That is actually what my lab does for a living, except for we also get data from the images and take it one step further and process it to see if we can actually distinguish what's in the image from other things in the image.
That's awesome. So if I'm remembering correctly, you recently established your own lab when you moved to St. Edward's. Is that correct?
Right.
Can you describe the process of that and what the challenges and kind of rewards have been so far?
So I'm, you know, St. Edward's is a principally undergraduate institution. So all of my research students are undergraduates, and those supervising undergraduates, you know, their primary responsibility is to get a degree. And so the hours that they put in each week during the academic year is fairly low compared to, say, folks that run research groups with graduate students, postdocs and things like that. But we're very productive in the summer. So the summer is really key because that's when we do full-time work. And it's, you know, it's interesting. We often have lots of good research ideas, and setting up a group, especially now I'm in year three, it's less the ideas and, you know, kind of the, you know, the research eureka moments, but it's more about the project management and personnel management and just being a good manager and a good project manager, but also a good people manager. Those are often, and at least in my mind, those can be the most challenging. And oftentimes for scientists, that's not what we actually have a degree in, right? Like you might have gotten experience with, you know, I run my project, I know my science, but kind of being chief financial officer of your lab while also being human resources, while also being, you know, the grant head grant writer, while also being, you know, all of these other hats that comes to you with on the job training, shall we say. And so that was, you know, being the head honcho means, no, that's all me now. And, you know, maybe an added challenge being at a PUI is I don't have graduate students. There aren't like layers of expertise. While my senior students that are literally seniors are super awesome, and they do often train, say, first year students or new students to the lab, You know, if you're in a kind of a bigger R1 type group where you might have visiting scientists, postdocs, graduate students, undergraduate, you have like layers of expertise in management. And so that can potentially kind of mitigate some of the things at, in at PUIs. I don't, for the most part, you don't have that. And I certainly don't have that. So I'm the chief of everything, CFO, CEO, like whatever, of those things in the lab. And so that's been, you know, effectively managing a group and mentoring students in a way that, you know, prepares them for what's, you know, coming next, and to, you know, in some way, you know, contribute to their overall professional training as chemists and researchers in whatever they go on to do next, but also to run a group in a team of people in an effective way, but it's also a, you know, healthy work environment that is, you know, a place where people can actually thrive in their projects and in their development as a professional. Some of those kind of managerial things are the ones that are the hardest, not the research, not the data analysis. Not to say that that isn't hard, but but the management side is the thing, I think. And I'm lucky in some ways in that I worked full-time during college. Most of the time I was in college, and I was manager in a retail store. So I feel like a lot of those skills as far as scheduling, payroll, you know, kind of multitasking, meetings with project goals and metrics, some of those things I feel like that weren't as tricky for me because of my previous work history. And also that academia is kind of career number two for me. So I kind of pulled in some experience from other jobs to help me do, quote, the soft skills, which I think are actually the hardest, which is all the managerial administrative things. And so, but juggling all of that and being at a PUI where the teaching load tends to be fairly high, while also wanting to have a productive lab and have, you know, suitable output for my students, juggling that is probably the hardest part.
Absolutely. So it sounds like you wear a lot of hats, and that's really impressive. Can you tell me what career number one was?
So, well, I worked for a long time in college in retail, and then actually I left graduate school and worked at a crime lab for a few years, and then I decided to go back into academia. So I've had a lot of fun experience, and I think that everything prepared me in some way, the different skill sets. And I worked it as an adjunct for a couple years. I think everything kind of comes together and you pull different skill sets, transferable skills, I believe is what they're called. And you see that, right, a lot in people make career changes. Sometimes it doesn't really feel like a career change. It's just, you know, I'm taking this set of skills and now applying it to a new, almost like a new research problem. And scientists do that all the time where, you know, you have a particular instrument or methodology that you're really good at. And maybe you were looking at this one system, but now you're like, that system's dead to me. I'm going to look at this one. or you have a collaborator that really just needs your just try something new. So it's been, in some ways, it's very different. Academia is its own environment. But I'm glad that some of the previous work skills have definitely come in handy.
For sure. Where do you see your career going in the next 5 to 10 years? What are your overall goals?
Fingers crossed they get tenure, which I'm sure that's the hope of many junior faculty. And I just hope to continue to have a productive group. I think that one of the things I enjoy the most, in addition to, you know, the classroom, is I really do like managing my group and seeing students really come into their own as far as their kind of role as researchers and scholars and their movement towards truly independent scholars. And that's really exciting to see that. And so I hope I get to do more of that. I would love to secure, besides, of course, tenure and things like that, I would love to secure enough funding to actually take on postdocs and have that training opportunity as well. And so I'm hoping to kind of to grow my lab in addition to the almighty tenure, which always seems to be floating out there for us.
Absolutely. That's always a huge goal in academia. So switching gears a bit, since you were really focused on education and teaching in your career, what can professional societies and organizations like ACS do to better support you in academia, to include, your students, as well as, matters of diversity and inclusion? And that's a lot of things rolled into one.
It is.
But I just want to hear how we can improve as a society and how we can better serve our constituents.
So I think there's lots there. I'll tackle one first in that, a lot of, and this is changing because there's great PhD programs in chemical education, and people, luckily, thankfully, is that chemical education research and practice is gaining in value and support. And so at the college level. And so I think, still though, a lot of professors, they got a PhD in, a very, organic chemistry and synthesis of blah, blah, blah. And you can tell I'm not an organic chemist, but they have a very, you get a PhD for the work that you did, for the management of that, project, and it's very, very narrow. And then all of a sudden you're supposed to be an educator and a mentor and a project leader and again, a CFO, a CEO, and all of these things. And definitely the teaching, even if you did a TA in school, it's very different than thinking about pedagogy and curriculum design. And, some of these things that in order to be, truly innovative and effective on campus as an educator, that it's just not in your wheelhouse. And so, and I see that, of course, in ACS is offering, through Division of Chemical Education, opportunities for professional development in that way. And so that, as far as trainings go, and, ACS has supported, say, new faculty workshops, which have included things like curriculum and pedagogy and, teaching practice and things like that. And so that, I think, is a really big benefit. To continue offering, workshops and trainings and areas where practitioners can get support, because it's just, for a lot of folks, it's just not in that, in their previous professional experience. And within that, of course, it comes, questions of, when you think about any kind of education impact, is issues of recruitment and retention and equity, diversity, and inclusion. To really have an equitable classroom in STEM, what does that mean? What does it look like? And talking about, the sociological ramifications of education and how we can be better educators by considering these issues. And again, more training and support in those avenues. We often, even within, say, ACS, you can have some great programming on, active learning and all of these kind of educational components, but as far as thinking critically about fostering an equitable classroom, looking at decolonizing the syllabi, being very thoughtful about the words and descriptors we use, considering the role of, systems of oppression, how certain students are afforded opportunities at every level of education and access. And those are conversations that shouldn't just be pushed off to the side to, oh, well, the Committee on Minority Affairs is looking at that. No, this is a direct day-to-day impact on people that are in the classroom, both students and faculty, or, as far as research groups and things like that. So that should be main stage agenda in the practitioning of our job. And the chemical enterprise is making sure that we are being as equitable and inclusive as possible. And so really integrating those concepts and practice and research into the everyday disciplines and running of our enterprise, rather than kind of pushing them and making them kind of side things. And so really moving them to the forefront, which you're seeing more and more of that, especially within divisional conversations on education. So I think you know, ACS needs to continue to really push those things as they're not side topics. They're not, quote, special topics. They are, you know, they underpin what we do as a society. If not every member of our society is able to participate in an equitable way, then we have to ask ourselves if we're really a society for all professionals. And that's a tough question. That's a question that every member is going to really need to ask themselves. Is it truly the American Chemical Society, a society that we like to say is the biggest one in the world, and that really speaks to all of those involved in the chemical enterprise? Are we actually meeting that mission by how we behave, by what we give attention to, by what we value and what we support? And that is something that we have to really be critical about. Are we really doing that to the best of our ability? And I think now is definitely the time to ask ourselves those tough questions.
Absolutely. These are really important questions. Do you have any examples of what you do in your lab and in your classroom to, as you say, decolonize the syllabus, promote diversity and inclusion in general?
Try to be really, you know, thoughtful in just everything that I do, and also to have my syllabi reviewed by other folks across campus. We have a lot of resources at St. Edward's, you know, Center for Teaching Excellence, which many campuses do, but also our student disability services, you know, student affairs. You know, there are lots of places that might have, say, you know, the Office of Diversity, Inclusion, and Equity, where they offer all types of services as far as, you know, what types of words are you using in your syllabus? What types of statements are you using in your syllabus? And who are you citing? You know, as far as, you know, is everything, say, male, pale, and stale, right? As far as the works you choose to highlight, you know, everything from who you quote to, you know, what you're perpetrating in your, you know, again, what you lend time to and what you put forward is what people are going to assume you support and who you support. And so in my own kind of overhaul, I also, you know, heard some great bit of advice was for syllabus is whatever you put first is what the students think that you think is the most important. And that really gave me a lot to think about how to reorganize syllabi that I can stress what I think is important. And so that's why now my letter to students, as well as a statement regarding how we will treat each other, which includes a statement on personal pronouns and why respectful, inclusive, equitable behavior is and actions and being thoughtful is really critical to teamwork, that appears on page one, not, you know, buried in page eight, which, again, it might be really important to you, but I have to demonstrate its importance. And then having my syllabi critiqued and reviewed by people who are experts in educational psychology, in, you know, our centers of teaching excellence, and making sure that the things that maybe I thought were okay are not okay, and then how they're reviewed, and also using, you know, different surveys to solicit input from students as far as what they thought was useful or helpful. And being open to feedback from super educational experts, but also from students to see, you know, did this do what I kind of wanted it to do or what we wanted it to do? Or did we just totally miss the mark, or did it have some, you know, positive, you know, consequences that we didn't intend, or negative? And all of that kind of feedback and review, kind of approaching it the same way we would approach our science, is to approach the practice of teaching and running a research group in a very similar way. And there's just some really great work that I know my colleagues on campus do. So I'm always, you know, visiting RCTE and going to different events and learning about that whole skill set. And there's just great, you know, national groups and, you know, again, the programming that you can hear, say, in the CHED division or sponsored, co-sponsored with CMA or things like that, of being, you know, really being thoughtful about this process has been really informative to how I kind of administer. And I'm still learning. I mean, I'm only in year three. And so I'm also giving myself a little bit of time to learn how to be better, but also to say, this is definitely not my area of expertise. I'm an analytical chemist. And so I need to kind of reach out to and utilize those resources to kind of do a better job.
For sure. It sounds like you've been extremely thoughtful about the whole process, which is very impressive. The effort is what's important. Given all of what we've talked about, what advice would you give to the next generation of chemists?
I would say do better than we did. But also that doing better means that you have to actively do better. I know for myself, you know, when we think about, and this is not just me, but there are a lot of folks that, you know, when you look at the glass ceiling and when you look at the numbers when it comes to, you know, what is sometimes called leaky pipeline, and where representation, where we are and where we really should be and are not, there's sometimes this thought, well, oh, we just need to wait until those old dinosaurs that are in our way retire, or worse, sometimes people say, that we can just wait them out. And then when they're all gone, things will be magically different. And that's not true, because everybody has said that. I've said it when I was, you know, a young Padawan, and people ahead of me, I know, have said it, and people ahead of them have said it, all the way down the line, as if it was a passive thing. You could wait for change, and it takes active change. I'm going to be, for myself and my group, I will be a better mentor, and I will have a more equitable research group and classroom. I will change the small circle I'm at. And on hiring committees, I'll be aggressive in my diversity, inclusion, and equity work. And on the scholarship committees, I will be so. Because if my generation of old people are now the ones, I'm now the person that somebody might be saying, I can't wait till this person's out of here so everything's better, right? Like, I need to be, because I'm going to hire the next group of people. And they're going to hire the next group of people. And they're going to be the gatekeeper, or, you know, gateway to everybody else. And so there is no waiting. If, you know, you have to be that kind of cliche of you have to be the change you want to see in the world. But, you know, if you're in any kind of position where you have a say in admissions and access to opportunities, whether it's in hiring or scholarships or fellowships or anything like that, there is that avenue of which you can affect change. So that you can, you know, change is happening now rather than the continued mythology of we just need to wait for all these people to retire and then it'll be great, because the next people down the line were all groomed and trained by those people. So we have to do better. That's kind of I'm trying to do better in my own daily life of dropping, you know, not only just bad habits, but habits that aren't necessarily bad, or methods that are not necessarily bad. I mean, absolutely, you should not do those. But the ones that aren't they're just not the best, right? Striving to adopt ones that are more the best, most equitable practices rather than just drop the really bad ones. And so I think that would be, you know, my advice is to work for change. But sometimes you can be like, oh my God, there's so much going on. How am I going to change academia? I certainly can't change academia, but I can maybe affect how I'm going to run my group and how I'm going to run my classroom. Some small corner of the academic universe, I may have some margin of control over. And I'm going to stick in that lane and try to make it the best lane that I can. And so that would be my long-winded advice would be to stay to your lane and make it the best lane that you can.
That is really great advice. Well, Rachelle, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been a really interesting conversation. So if you have any other questions for me or want to follow up with more statements, you can definitely reach out. But I just really appreciate your time, and I will let you enjoy your weekend now.
Well, thank you. Thanks for reaching out.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We have with us Dr. Terry Quinn Gray. Thanks for doing this. This is an idea that we had to celebrate Black History Month, and we thought it'd be a good idea since we had the St. Elmo Brady landmark being dedicated this
yeah.
month. And so we've
wow,
been
wow, yeah.
Yeah, highlighting.
Yeah, so where is it? Yeah, tell me. So I don't know much about it, you know, the landmark itself.
Yeah, let's find out where. I don't know exactly where it's located, but let's find out here. He has.
Okay.
I can find that for you, actually.
Yeah, I don't need it right now. Sure, yeah.
I can find it for you. I assumed it was at the university where he was.
That was Chicago, Tuskegee, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I know he was a lot of places.
He was a lot of places. So, yeah, I have to look that up, actually. That's a good question. The Landmarks program was highlighting five African-American chemists that were influential in chemistry. And
yeah.
And so I was promoting him here at ACS and on social media and everything. And we thought, well, let's have a podcast episode where we have influential, our current chemists and see what influenced them to become chemists and so on. So that's the information behind this call.
Okay.
So I guess to get started right off, it's like, well, what did inspire you to become a chemist?
Well, you know, I would say I evolved or molded into a chemist, perhaps due to many inspirational moments and nurturing experiences over time. I didn't have a real aha moment, nor did I even plan on being a chemist. So there was no official chemistry set as a young child for me. I grew up asking a lot of questions and not being afraid to get into something I knew little or nothing about. So I really had several STEM-oriented experiences starting in middle school through high school, most of them at Jackson State University in Mississippi. That's my hometown. And some names that, you know, some programs like Minority Access to Research Careers, MARC, Minority Biomedical Research Support Program, MBRS, and the ACS Project SEED were all very pivotal and defining to my journey as a chemist. They all laid the foundation for me for the only real seed that counts that I'm most proud of, and that's a seed for confidence. So I've been curious about how things work. You know, I appreciate numbers and the stories they tell qualitatively and quantitatively. I'm already inclined towards balance, right? Mass balance, if you will. And I get real excited about change, chaos, and transformation. And I thrive in interdisciplinary environments. So that's what chemistry is, right? It's the study of matter and the transformation of that matter. So being a chemist allows all of that for me personally, you know, from concept to realization. So I've touched things such as analytics and chemical mass balance models, atmospheric science, production agriculture, material science now. I'm not sure if there's any other discipline or career path that could allow you to do all of that in one, you know, in one swoop.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's great to hear that some of the programs that ACS had were in there. To get you in, that's a load off. That's good. But did you have any chemist or scientist in your family that were influenced you or anything like that? Or I mean, what got you even kind of, you know, what put chemistry on your radar? I mean, you said the things you liked to do, and
yeah.
you know, and you're like, but what was it about chemistry that kind of said, oh, that's chemistry? Because I don't know if a lot of people know that chemistry has all those things built into it, if chemistry is not even on their map, you know?
Right. So, you know, I go back to programs like Minority Access to Research Careers and Minority Biomedical Research Support. And being a part of those programs, which were seated at Jackson State University, they were on a mission actually to increase the participation of underrepresented groups in the sciences. And Jackson State, historically Black college, has a powerful chemistry program then in the early 80s, late 70s, as they do now. And so they just really, you know, gave us all of the foundational terms of the academics, but they put us in laboratories, right? We were sitting in laboratories as middle and high school students next to graduate students at the time and professors. And so I really actually got to touch the chemistry, right? Even though probably my very early years, I wasn't doing a whole lot of real chemistry, you know, as a high school student until I got to maybe Project C later. But I've been doing research since I was seventh grade. And so when I got that C and that interest, you know, it grew from there. And I am, so, you know, from a family perspective, no chemist in my family. My aunt, I was one of the first physics majors, maybe the first female physics major at Jackson State University as an undergrad. My mother is a mathematician, a math teacher of almost 40 years of middle school math. I've been kind of STEMified, you know, from that perspective. But yeah, I'm the first chemist, if you will.
Okay. Yeah. But you really spoke, those programs really gave you that access to science and that access and exposure to science. And then they did their job. I mean, they exposed you to it and then you went from there and then based that on things that you like to do.
I mean, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That is great. I mean, that's really, I think, what everyone who has programs for young kids is to give them that exposure and then say, hey, look what you can do now in this exposure, find something that really speaks to you.
And that's right.
Go
that's
out.
Right. And that, yeah. And that hands-on and being in an environment where you can see it and touch it and other people are doing it just made a difference. Right. And it's all about exposure. And it was one of those that kept inviting me in, kept challenging me. I can still remember, you know, I think I may have been enamored, you know, in seventh grade with the white coat and the, you know, the goggles, because that was kind of unique relative to what my friends were doing, you know, in their summers, you know, in the summer sports camps, which I did as well. But no one really had that, you know, that lab coat that I would kind of bring home and kind of talk about. So it was all of that that I liked, the research, the hands-on, particularly, you know, solving problems that were to me very, you know, mind-boggling, you know, really tough. All of that kind of just was in my groove. Yep.
Yeah. Great. Well, what, now that you've been doing chemistry, how has the field changed since you started your career, or has it?
Oh my goodness. That's a loaded question.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, from one, you know, clearly, right, the technological advances in the common era, right, in the last 20 years have been amazing. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is just look at the 2018 Nobel Prize in Chemistry, right? This is directed evolution of enzymes, design molecules for biofuels, pharmaceuticals. I mean, that's chemistry on steroids, in my view, right? That is just amazing. And then, the things that are just kind of part of the shift for me every day and what I see around is like the whole proliferation of artificial intelligence tools to accelerate discovery and development of new materials where, you know, that was, you know, teams of 15, 20 people really trying to manage, you know, 100 ideas to today, it's 1,000 ideas. And how do we accelerate that, you know, particularly in the discovery space? So that's a big change, right? That's a huge change in terms of what those technological advances are, right? I was reading in CNN News about carbon nanotubes for computers, right? It's almost an oxymoron, but I have to read more about that. So it's just, the changes are huge. I think on the other side, though, you know, the other angle around at the beginning of my career, this pre-college experience that I just, you know, shared with you, you know, I was highly encouraged to pursue academic studies in chemistry with sites on a MD or PhD. So, you know, the ultimate at that time for me or my perspective was academia, the professoriate or medical school. Today, I see that narrative changing, and rightly so, to intentionally expose students to various levels of credential certifications, two-year associates, including the bachelor's, master's, PhD, but those experiences and credentials that are aligned with the realities of the global marketplace today. right? One that includes research and development, but also tech transfer, manufacturing technology, policy, entrepreneurship. And I guess in terms of preparation, probably jobs in areas that haven't even been invented yet, right? So in addition to that traditional academia and medical school pathways, that narrative has changed and should change that is much more relevant to the global marketplace. The other thing that I think has changed, you know, now that you make me think about it, I think the perception of chemists and chemistry is shifting.
Okay.
Probably not as much as some of us would like in terms of the pace, but I think we are shifting from stereotypes of, you know, white men in white coats with crazy wild hair and explosions, right? This sense of fear, unapproachable, to one that's shifting to the general public is really struggling to understand what we as chemists actually do and how it's relevant to everyday lives. So, you know, chemistry appears to be out of touch with a lot of the masses in some cases. And this is a gap that we can and must close with role models, with diverse backgrounds, with diverse networks, positive examples to show how chemistry is foundational to so many other disciplines. So I worry that the perception of chemists is shifting, but not necessarily really embracing the relevance of chemistry to everyday. That's
okay.
Our biggest pain.
Yeah. So I mean, when you were speaking about the kind of the end goal. So for you, it was academia, it was a PhD, or medical school. And saying now it's changing to their certifications and different things that meet with the marketplace. Do you think do you think that opens up opportunities for underrepresented folks to get into chemistry and get into science? Or do you think that creates more confusion and a potential barrier to getting into chemistry or science?
Oh, definitely the former. I think it opens up more opportunities for all demographics and people to participate in chemistry. You know, to say that you must pursue advanced degrees to participate in the profession and have that messaging come out loud and clear, or as stringent as it was for me, I think really did close the doors for many to participate because it is necessary. We know we need those MD PhDs. I'm not saying we don't, but in addition to, there's so many other ways to participate in the profession and to contribute. The global marketplace needs it, and it just wasn't a part of the conversation. I think it's definitely the former. It opens up many more possibilities for more people to participate.
Yeah. I like the what you were saying about not only that, but then adding the role models and adding putting in front of people that, hey, there are people who look like you that are in this discipline is very important. And that is basically one of the, not only for recognition, but one of the reasons for the National Historic Landmarks in chemistry are to do that, are to highlight folks and the things that they've done to say, yeah, there were people like you back in the day, you know, that were doing things. And it is possible, you know, it is something that you can do now with all the other opportunities that opened up and all the educational opportunities and the marketplace opportunities to look back and say, yeah, in, you know, 1916, here is someone who got a PhD in chemistry, and they went on and they discovered this. That's very important. So my question for you is the National Chemistry Landmarks, and the one for St. Elmo Brady is in Illinois, University of Illinois. That's where it was dedicated at the beginning of this month. But he was at a lot of places: Tuskegee, Howard, University of Tougaloo College, So it's just a lot of places. Fisk, I think it was there. But what do those landmarks like St. Elmo Brady and the others? What do they mean to you?
Yeah, you know, I think you hit it on the head there. You know, landmarks, you know, for instance, the landmark in honor for Dr. Brady is just inspiring, right? It gives me a visible reminder at this time in my career that I too can make a contribution within the chemical profession. Because sometimes, you know, I can be one of very, very few in an organization or in a group still today in 2019. And so to be, you know, not have a critical mass of folks who look like me in a place where, you know, the dynamics are geared toward more of a majority conversation or persuasion, if you just need that inspiration and visible reminder that, you know, I too have a place and a contribution to make within the profession. But even more so, right, he represents more than a scientist, a great scientist. He was an accomplished scholar. He was highly regarded as a teacher and an educational leader, which for me is personally, is probably one of the most influential of STEM careers, right, this education and teacher piece of his portfolio. You know, so it's important for me professionally, personally, but it's also important for those folks who are looking for, you know, a reason and a connection to see themselves in the profession and to understand his story in 2016, what that looked like and what his options were, you know, in the academic space particularly, and how what he did in 1960 and throughout his life. I think he probably lived to the 60s or something, right? I forget the story, but I remember his story in my head. And, you know, his longtime career, even after he had retired, you know, we know the story in Jackson, Mississippi, where he helped to establish the chemistry department at Tougaloo College, right, my hometown. So, you know, there's so many ways I connect to him. But yes, his message, his character, his example, both as a scholar, as an educator, and a scientist, speaks to the breadth of what you can do with a chemistry degree and training.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he lived until 1966, I do believe. So
yeah.
You know, so and you're right. I mean, those he was more than just the scientist, but when you read about him and the things he worked on, you know, pyruvic acid and so on, it's in my training growing, you know, dealing with, you know, pyruvic acid, I never thought that, you know, an African-American scientist or scholar worked on this. You know, it was just it didn't even dawn on me. But going back and reading, it's like, wow, that is so inspiring. And did so much. And when you think about some of the other things that were going on in the world, you know, against, you know, immigrants, against African American, against, you know, people of different religious groups, and to say, you know, women, you know, when we're going against women in these times, you know, and to say that here's someone who's persevering and made a difference.
That's right.
You know, it's just,
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned that. And I remember reading something about he did these study leaflets for Household Chemistry for Girls while he was at Tuskegee, right? And the introduction says, you know, to me, I was interpreting it to say he's really trying to make chemistry real and relevant again to the everyday lives of girls. Now, probably the situation was like, I'm not sure how many girls were at Tuskegee, you know, fully enrolled right at that time, or what that looked like. But he, you know, here he is opening the door for true diversity and inclusion through his power, influence as an educational leader, as a scholar, you know, on the campus. So he did these series of leaflets. So I would love to get my hands on those just to understand. But, you know, what really were the content? But the ones that I heard about, and again, this is part of the story if you're at Tougaloo College at some time, right, a friend of mine there, about how that was so important for, again, an educator, someone who is highly regarded as you know, as Dr. Brady, to really to open the door for everybody to participate in the chemical sciences in chemistry. I mean, that's the ultimate, right? That's the ultimate.
Yeah. And I mean, it was 1917. That's when he did a 66 page monograph, Household Chemistry for Girls. I just, you know, sit and look at
oh,
that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was 1917. Okay. And I think, you know, that was before the vote. That was before,
right.
You know, and here he is.
And to put it in the title, right? He put it in the title, right?
Yeah. Put it in the title. It's like, and I mean, I only think that Zakir is an African-American man promoting science and chemistry to girls in 1917. I was just thinking, how scandalous was that? Or how just...
Right. He's a maverick. Maverick. Yes.
You know, and it's so wonderful to think that here, you know, that's there and forming the undergraduate program for chemistry and all that. It's one of those things that I get. I'm always in awe of, you know, and I look back at myself and thinking, well, I don't think I'm that strong. I don't think.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I think about it is, you know, given that just the circumstances and the breadth and the impact that he had, I should be able to do a whole lot more just living, you know, from the foundations and springboarding from what he's put out there already. I have no excuse not to do a little bit, but I should be doing a whole lot more. You know?
Right. It's like with all the education and the technology and the, like,
right,
wow,
right,
I'm not even living up to what he did before he was, you know, 17.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So yeah. With that and with people like him, what can professional societies like ACS and academic institutions do to better support diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, I don't like the word support diversity and inclusion. I think the professional societies and our academic institutions particularly should actually be advocating and really themselves
the drivers,
organizationally drivers of diversity and inclusion. Particularly since the academic institutions are really shaping the minds and hearts of many of our students who are then actually, right, full participants in the profession, contributors later. And the professional societies, which are kind of the caretakers, right, a kind of bringing together all the different sectors and memberships to really help people understand their careers and connections, you know, to the professions in various ways. So I really would, you know, see the professional societies, academic institutions be drivers of this, really setting the tone, setting the culture, really putting in the foundation. And I know it starts first internally, right? And so really, what does that mean in terms of giving folks the background and the space? When I say the comfort, a comfortable space to have courageous conversations about why diversity and inclusion is not easy, particularly from an American perspective, U.S. perspective. It's a tough discussion. There's a lot of history and a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of psychological strife associated with it. So we have to create space for courageous conversations. And I think that's the first internally to do that. Then there's policy and programs that actually say diversity and inclusion are a core value that helps lay the foundation and basis for decision making on how we invest, where we invest, people, advocacy, that whole piece. Then externally, once you have it internally, kind of in the, you know, in the zone and really being a pillar and a leader, I think externally then you take it the next step and walk the talk and advance the diversity and inclusion conversation by raising awareness among stakeholders, really promoting the recognition and dissemination of information with role models and achievements of the membership and staff and stakeholders. All of that, right, you know, under the umbrella that chemistry is relevant to all of us in our everyday lives, but showing it from a diversity and inclusion perspective. That's what I think we should and can do. I don't think it's that far away from reality. It's just really a matter of courageous will and courage, you know, courageous will of our leaders to do that.
Yeah, I agree. And I was just thinking, not only having those courageous conversations is very important, but I was thinking also those conversations are made even more complicated when you think of the global perspective. So ACS is a global, striving to be an even more global organization. What are those diversity and inclusion conversations look like when you're talking about China or Europe and so on? Because it's a little bit out of the American, the North American, United States type perspective. Even in Latin America, it's different. So. Yeah. So having those conversations and making sure that we're all on the right, singing the right note, or at least having a conversation, because they may be very different conversations, and they may be very different perspectives when you take in that global, and that's just as meaningful and needs to happen if you want to be truly inclusive on a global scale and a global perspective.
Yeah, you know, so thank you so much for that. You know, the global piece, for me, the global conversation, there are different contexts. Mm-hmm. If you look at the international boundaries, right, the U.S. perspective, the European perspective, African, Asian, Latin America. But it's the roots of, getting to the humanity of each of us, regardless of where our geographical roots are, or even cultural roots are, and really start to say, start with, we have something that we can do together that's bigger than we can do alone. And how do we embrace the differences that we bring to the table? And knowing that that's going to be difficult, but really being persistent and true to honoring the humanity in each of us. I know that the conversation in Europe would be very different than the conversation in Asia. The conversation in the U.S. is different from coast to coast, much less the U.S. is not some monolithic body, if you will, right?
Yeah.
So I think globalization and diversity and inclusion go hand in hand. And when I say globalization, as to your point, it is all inclusive of the globe as we know it, right? But it's really more mindset than it is trying to build or just determine where the boundaries are, but really how do you cut across the boundaries? And if it works, that mindset works in whatever country you start, because we're going to be very customized around how we listen, but not necessarily on how we engage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
thank
you. That's great. Well, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to have you have a last thought about what advice would you give that next generation of chemists?
Be fearless, right? Find what you like. Work hard at it. Don't shy away from change or your fears, embrace them. Surround yourself with great people and know that chemistry and the chemical profession can give you all of that and more, right? It's one of the few disciplines and areas out there that you can participate in almost every work sector with the foundation and the skills that come with, analytical reasoning, research, laboratory, testing, the analytics, the basics of what it takes to be a great chemist will allow you to participate in a plethora of possibilities. Be fearless.
I love that. Be fearless. I think that is great advice. Well, Dr. Terry Quinn Gray, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to participate in our Black History Month ACS Voices podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to ACS Voices,
the Diversity Podcast, produced by the American Chemical Society and 1016 Studios in Washington, D.C.